and shook. Soup splattered his thighs. After the meal, he stepped out into the street. The air in the house was stifling, but it felt little better out there. Go to her. Don't go. Trust her. Do as she asked. Go to her. Keep away. Don't push. You could lose her forever. He was pacing, swearing, looking down at his feet. He walked right into his father's chest.
It's that bad, is it? Said the old man.
Yes, said Condry.
But I don't feel like talking about it.
If you tell me the truth, I'll try to help you.
Oh, horse shit!
He was almost as shocked by his words as the old man himself, but he pressed on.
Help me, Papa? Tell the truth. You'd just sneer. You'd explain what I should have done, what you would have done. But I know all about your approach. I lived it, up there on the mountain.
His father was despicably composed.
I couldn't bring your mother down here, Condry. Things were complicated. I wish I could make you understand.
Condry laughed in his face.
You had two women at the same time, and you got them both with child. You left us up there so no one would know.
It's not complicated, Papa. It's cruel.
You don't have the whole story.
I don't want another story.
Do you know how cold it was in winter? Do you know what we ate?
People died up there, Papa. She died.
And all of a sudden you want to help?
His father shrugged. Open up to someone else, then. Keeping all that steam inside can't feel good.
He started to turn away. Condry grabbed his arm and held tight.
This matters to me, Papa. More than anything ever has.
I can tell, said his father.
And that's why I won't talk to you. When have you ever trusted me with what matters to you?
I used to ask, remember? And you'd tell me to get lost.
Lanthor Hinjuman closed his eyes. He raised his hand, felt for Condry's own where it gripped his arm. Their fingers interlaced. For the first time in his life, Condry knew he'd struck the target. The war in the old man's heart was as plain to see as the stubble on his chin. Would he speak? Would he give the trust he was asking for? His father opened his eyes, and the answer was written there.
No, not yet.
He was almost in tears. They both were. But somehow he conjured his old wolfish smile.
I'd be a true prick, wouldn't I? He said. Not to respect a man for keeping secrets?
Yes, said Condry.
You would.
That night Condry slept in the courtyard with the dogs. He could not face another grilling by Mektu, he told himself. But there was another reason. From the yard he could slip away without alerting his brother. It was easy to imagine, clawing over the temple wall, blundering into the sanctuary, smacking old Mars away from Arikina, leading her out by the hand. But lead her where, save into disgrace and the loss of her clinic, her dream? He lay there with a dog for a pillow, watching the stars wheel overhead. He must have slept, for in the dead of the night he thought he woke to the squeak of the front gate and footsteps fading on the cobbles. But in fact his sleep was only half broken, and though he struggled, he was soon once more in its embrace. Just before dawn, he snapped fully awake. Mektu was seated beside him, eyes open, legs crossed, hands folded in his lap. His stillness unnerving. Condry felt certain he had been there a long time, staring fixedly at nothing, at the ghosts only he could see. The next morning, a rumor began to creep through the villages. Dr. Arikina Nawal had disappeared. The Hinjuman boys were the first to raise the alarm, but the town was slow to heed them. Most patients found their way to the clinic, but Arikina had never been known to turn away a summons to the bedside of one too ill to travel, even if that meant tramping for hours along the black and rutted roads. Like as not, she was in Stone Gate or Ashfield or some farther village and would find her way home before sunset. There was reason to doubt such a notion.
Arikina had a day shift at the clinic and had neglected to call for a replacement. She might have forgotten, but it would have been the first time in her short career. Of course, she had been seen the night before in the company of Father Mars. It was commonly supposed that she had gone to him to discuss some crisis of the spirit. Young women often did. Mars himself reported that she had left the temple at 10:30 of the evening. Not a soul had seen her since. Arikina's office was locked. The duty nurse thought little of it until one of the patients remarked that he had heard soft voices, one of them Dr. Nawal's, coming from the office well after midnight. The voices had sounded friendly, even playful. A strange occurrence, but not an alarming one. The nurse pondered this information another quarter hour before locating the spare key. The office was in disarray. An empty cotton whiskey bottle stood on Arikina's desk. Beside it was a letter announcing her resignation as founding director, followed by several pages of precise case histories for her patients, recommendation for their care, and detailed accounts of the clinic's finances. They would find, in days ahead, that every last gam tallied. Whatever Dr. Nawal had been up to, theft had played no part. Her writing was very neat, but the page itself was blotched with water, or whiskey, and below her name she had added a hasty scrawl. Her denmates drive her from the cave that was her own. Let them beware, she may return a panther, fully grown. The passage rang a bell, but no one could quite place it until Naredi Hingeman revealed that it was part of the War Choral, her brother Mektu's favorite book.
He can't find time for scripture, but he can recite that profane verse in his sleep. The gods save my family. They live like beasts, I tell you. Not one of them walks in the light.
Mektu confirmed that he knew the passage, and also that he had lent his copy of the choral to Arikina not long before. But when asked why she might have closed her letter with the words, he grew wary and said no more. With the discovery of the letter and the empty bottle, the brothers' fear caught like wildfire, and the upper Satapre mobilized. Every farmhand left his labor, every shop closed. Patients had to be restrained from walking out of the clinic, and a few could not be. A solid 1,000 volunteers descended on Blind Stream, where the constables did their best to organize them into search teams. Uncle Chindelin rode for Wolfkill to seek the army's help. The mystery grew more troubling the longer one considered it. Arikina was not given to drink. Her aunt and elder cousins were all the family she had. More to the point, she was universally loved. The clinic had changed lives and brought fame and better fortunes to Blind Stream. So had Arikina's famished pursuit of her medical degree. Few Valley youth had ever achieved such a level of scholarship. None who did so had remained, serving the needy in the place of their birth. Why would she abandon them? And where could she possibly go? Despite the letter, most people doubted that she had gone very far. No horses were missing. No stagecoach was scheduled to pass through the upper Satapre by night. She was lost, that was it. She had gone for a walk before bedtime and gotten lost. Anyone could, in the deep clefts and wooded hillsides surrounding Blind Stream. The town had some deadly hazards, too. There was an eroded cliff walk, and a stone quarry with several open pits. There was a boulder field where snakes were common, though most who were bitten managed to drag themselves into town. And of course, there was the spot that gave Blind Stream its name. A sinkhole in a distant meadow, though its shape was less hole than winding incision. Narrow enough for a man to step across, it was so overhung with grass that one could be within a yard and not know that it was there, save for the gurgling of the stream 20 feet below. These morbid possibilities were all swiftly eliminated. The search parties walked in long dragnets under the fierce afternoon sun. Arikina's name echoed through the hills. Khandri and Mektu were madly suspicious of each other. Whenever their paths crossed, a mutual interrogation began. Had Khandri truly not seen her after the wedding? And why had Mektu suddenly appeared at Khandri's side in the courtyard? Was it he who had opened the gate a few hours earlier, his footsteps Khandri had heard walking away? Khandri clung to the hope that Ari was somewhere nearby, She was in turmoil. They had made love with abandon that had frightened her, and though he spilled his seed upon her thigh or stomach, there was always the risk of an accident, wasn't there? Little accidents were all over the valley. Some of them lived in the orphanage down the road. She had been spied on, denounced to Father Mars. She had been forced to consider the insult of his cleansing ceremony. And Condry, who had not even summoned the courage to say, "I love you," had suddenly begged for her hand. It was all too much. Ari had felt smothered, and so she had indulged in a dream of escape, penned a letter to make it real. She wouldn't get too far, though. Good sense would return to her soon, if it hadn't already. "Go back," it would whisper. "Your people need you. Condry needs you. And you love him. You said it to his face." But other thoughts, like furtive assassins, slipped through his defenses as the day wore on. If she had fled, if she was leaving him for some other life, Condry knew she would make for Kasralis. That was her true dream. After the clinic, she longed for no other place. That foreign doctor was to blame. She had come spewing passions, conjuring visions of a better Uroth, painting the sky with rainbows. Arikina had never been the same. "A beautiful secret, Condry. Her work could change the world." But nearly 3 years had passed since Dr. Serim's visit. Why now? What would make Arikina drop everything and flee? Certainly not the bribe money, nor the prospect of a few humiliating hours with Father Mars. Unless it was more than humiliation. Condry, searching north of the village in a dense wood, stopped in his tracks.
"Ong's cunt," he said.
"Brother! The gods forgive you,"
cried Nereti, the nearest searcher on his left. Condry turned and started walking along the line, limbs shaking with rage. Mektu was 9 or 10 positions downhill. He started running. He called out for Mektu and eventually heard his brother's reply. They met in a clearing. Mektu's face glistened with sweat.
"I heard the gate close last night," said Condry without preamble. "I know you went out. Just tell me what happened. You saw her, didn't you?"
His brother hesitated, then turned away with a shake of his head.
"Stop fucking around," he said. "Get back on the line. You'll throw us all off." "What did you do to her, you shit?"
Mektu whirled. For several seconds, he could do nothing but gape.
"You think? You honestly believe I could..."
"I believe you lied about something."
They were circling each other.
"So what if I saw her?" said Mektu. "You sick fuck! I'd rather be stabbed dead than hurt Arikina."
"Where was she?"
"At the clinic. I didn't say anything because it was private. Condry, how could you imagine such a thing?"
Mektu gives him an imploring look.
"You know me better than anyone, don't you?"
That, of course, was precisely the question. Condry wondered if he would ever truly have an answer. But no, damn it to hell. He did not, could not, believe that Mektu had done Ari violence. "But if it wasn't you..." Condry turned back toward the village. He heard Mektu calling behind him. The soft forest floor, a quicksand of leaves. He broke into a run. More than humiliation. More than just an old man's lascivious lurches, a palsied hand grazing a breast. There were soldiers on the road to Blind Stream. Chindelin's call had been answered. Condry ran straight by them, ignoring their shouts, as he had ignored his brother's, passing the turnoff to his own house, the primary school, the empty market, racing along the path beside the aqueduct, into said Hemen. At the bamboo grove, he turned right and climbed to the temple.
He had some younger priests up from Ashfield, helping him.
The gates stood open. There were old women on the temple steps, laying out offerings of fruit and flowers to the gods. Condry bounded up the steps 3 at a time. The cries of the women reached the sanctuary, where those too frail or too important to join the search had gathered to pray. Father Mars, a wiry, hollow-cheeked old man in voluptuous black linen, moved among them. He saw Condry coming. judged his face and intentions. He dropped the silver prayer bowl and bolted for his life.
"Don't run!" bellowed Condry. "I need some fucking moral correction! Help! Help!" the old priest shouted. "Hingeman's boy has gone mad!"
In the rear of the transept, an iron gate led onto the stairs to the choir loft. Mars was fumbling with the lock as Condry closed on him. At the last possible moment, he wrenched the gate open, squeezed through, and slammed it behind him. There was an inner bolt, but as he tried to drive it home, Condry grabbed his hand and pulled his forearm through the bars. Mars squealed and clawed at him. Condry twisted his arm.
"You old horny bastard! What did you do to her? Stop! Stop! Anus of a swine!"
They were still at it when the constables appeared. Condry surrendered, but they beat him anyway, with truncheons and canes. He looked past them. The pain a dull and distant thing. Somewhere in this building, Arikina had chosen to break with the valley, to prune the branch back to the trunk, to abandon him. He was dragged to Blindstream's tiny jail, between the alderman's office and the dog pound. One bench, one bucket. The floor white with bird shit. The other two cells were occupied by a simpleton prone to pleasuring himself in schoolyards, and a shaggy mute convicted years before of murdering his father with a spade. Midnight. Mektu retires to the bedchamber in the farmhouse, still complaining about the medicine, and Talupeke leads the others back to Apuk's mill. The road is deserted. Condry breathes a little easier. They hurry downhill, barely speaking, until they reach the spur path into the ravine. It is darker within. Only a little moonlight glimmers on the trickling stream.
"Be silent now," says Talupeke. "And don't hold it against them if you're roughed up a bit."
"Roughed up?" says Chindelin. "What the hell do you mean? Are they going to beat us?"
"Only if you deserve it," says Talupeke.
The path hugs the ravine's north bank. Ahead loom the mill and the crumbling silos. As they proceed, the ravine grows wider, the hills receding to either side. Eventually, they emerge into a long, flat field, and Condry sees that the farm complex is larger than he thought. In addition to the mill and silos, half a dozen barns, warehouses, and meager homes are scattered about the field. All of them look careworn. Some are clearly abandoned. Condry finds himself wondering how many homes, how many dreams, ended with the river's demise.
"You're early, Tal."
Everyone but Talupeke jumps. The voice is like velvet, and it comes from the center of the stream. Condry looks down and sees a rock come to life, a head raised, a pair of arms unfolding from around bent knees, a figure rising in one smooth motion. Not a rock, but a man balanced upon one, perfectly at ease. His face in shadow, a black cloak hiding one arm.
"Were you seen?"
he asks.
"By a toad or two, maybe," says Talupeke. "You know who these people are?" "I can guess,
says the man, his voice stranger with each utterance.
"But guesswork is not for us, is it, Tal? Not for those who live hunted lives."
"I couldn't agree more," says Condry. The man pivots to face him.
"You will get further if you don't speak out of turn, Chiloto. A piece of friendly advice, that is. And here's another. Don't walk any closer to the mill."
"Why not?"
"Any number of reasons. You might find it a disappointment. A few tired donkeys, an old man who grinds corn, or you might find yourself wriggling on the end of a pike, Hard to tell, hard to tell."
Talupeke sighs.
"Mansari," she says. "You haven't changed a bit."
He leaps, a sudden blur, and alights soundlessly before them. Condry can see his face now, and gives another start. Is he looking at a man or a woman? The purring voice is that of a man, albeit a strange one. The face is sleek, with dark eyes that taper at the corners, small ears, hair cropped short enough for the prophet's army. The body is compact and slightly curvaceous. Disoriented, Condry watches him,
him, drop to one knee and lift Talupeke's hand. Rather than kiss it, he rubs his temple along her wrist, a strangely sensual gesture.
I've missed you, Tal.
Talupeke frees her hand.
My sergeant's dead, she says.
Stilts informed me,
says the other, gazing up at her.
I grieve with you, my dear. Your sergeant had the soul of a prince.
We'll avenge him, says Talupeke. The general will see to that. I'll ask his permission to lead the reprisal raid. Has he picked a target yet?
Mansari hesitates, then slowly rises to his feet.
We had better go inside, he says.
He leads them, hips swaying. Man, woman, both? Condry wonders again, across the field and behind one of the larger barns. The structure is decrepit, listing, the wall planks rotted out along the ground. Pausing by a window, Mansari gives a low trill with his tongue. From somewhere within comes an answering trill. The man proceeds to a small door and swings it wide. With some apprehension, they follow the stranger and Talupeke into the dark. The barn smells of urine and hay. Soft nicker of horses, a few tittering hens. Dimly, Condry perceives another man in the darkness. He approaches Mansari, exchanges a few whispered words.
Talupeke, what are we doing in a barn? Demands Eshet. Is your general here or not?
A match flares up with a serpent's hiss. Mansari is lighting a candle.
Step back a little,
he says. The second man crosses to a stall door and frees the latch. Inside, Condry dimly perceives the shape of an enormous draft horse. The animal snorts and stomps as he leads it from the stall.
Slowly, girl, that's the way, murmurs the second man.
The horse is laboring, pulling at two heavy ropes. Condry follows them with his eyes. They pass through pulleys suspended from the ceiling, descend again into the stall where the horse had stood, and end in great iron hooks, from which a great block of stone now dangles, shedding dust and hay as it rises. Beneath it, a dark hole gapes in the floor of the stall.
Quickly now,
says Mansari, plunging in with his trembling candle. Within the hole, a staircase is concealed.
Go,
says the man beside the horse.
Don't make her stand here bearing this weight.
In something of a chaos, they shuffle down the dark, steep stairs. Condry, at the rear, has barely ducked his head underground when the man starts to urge the horse backward, and the great stone lowers into place.
Boom.
He gropes for a wall, stumbles against Eshet, furious with his racing heart.
Don't make a fool of yourself, Condry. Talupeke's on your side. This isn't a trap.
But it is a tunnel, narrow and rough-hewn from the earth. Mansari's candle is already bobbing away. They follow, single file, for 100 paces or more. Chill air, clammy walls, a roof so low they have to stoop. Eventually, the bedrock walls give way to brick. A few steps farther, Mansari leads them out into a much larger room, low-roofed like the tunnel, but too large for the candle's meager light to reach the walls. Condry strains his eyes. Is that motion in the darkness? A shoulder? A faint glint of steel? Mansari blows the candle out, and in the sudden darkness, feet approach from every direction at once. Condry lunges for Eshet, pulls her close. He draws his machete, holding her tight in the crook of his left arm, brandishing the blade. There is a stab of lamplight, followed at once by other lights from every side. Dazzled, Condry glimpses brutal faces, hard hands, lowered spears. They are surrounded by some 20 men.
Steady, Condry, says Chindelin beside him. We're here to talk, remember?
I understood that you were, here to beg, says Mansari.
Their weapons are confiscated. The men are gruff and thorough, but not overtly hostile. The room is plain stone, like a large prison cell, and now Condry sees that the last brick section of the tunnel projects well into the chamber, allowing, he realizes, for newcomers to be surrounded as soon as they emerge.
About face, gentlefolk, says one of the warriors.
Condry turns and sees that Mansari is standing by a sturdy door opposite the tunnel. It opens a crack, and Mansari exchanges whispers with someone just inside. Then he looks over his shoulder, puts a finger to his lips, and beckons. The door swings wide. The guards step back. One by one, the travelers slip through the door. The chamber beyond reeks of smoke, liquor, bad breath, unwashed skin. It is very crowded. There is a round table, above which three iron lamps dangle, hissing. Around the table, a dozen men and women sit in high-backed chairs, their shadows flung behind them like capes. About them cluster another 60 or 70 figures, seated on crates and stools, or leaning with folded arms against the walls. The whole group is arguing, passionately but without shouting, as though they fear to be overheard. Heads turn to study the newcomers. Their eyes, wary, wounded, sizing up the travelers with unflinching directness, leave no doubt in Condry's mind. These are soldiers. They have seen blood. Their abundant weaponry an unneeded confirmation. Tabasa's fighters, Condry thinks. The debate does not pause.
Friendship, someone is saying. Did I hear correctly? Would you truly waste our time with that word?
The speaker is a large man with a dark purple birthmark, vaguely insect-shaped, upon his forehead. He stands behind one of the high-backed chairs, training his small, bright eyes on one warrior after another.
What friends have we? He demands. What friends has the Lutaral ever had? Oh, we have tactical partnerships. For a week, a fighting season, a year or two at the most. But friends? Not a one. Friends do not forget you, or begin to slander and conspire against you the moment they feel that they can live without your aid.
It required friendship to overthrow the Khosraj, says a woman standing against the far wall, her muscular arms crossed over her chest. The Western clans fought as one then, Spider, and we handed the Emperor his head.
Legends, sister, says another woman, much older, with deep-set eyes and a thick mane of silver hair, seated at the table near the speaker. Who can say why the Empire fell? You also hear that their cattle starved, that a volcano opened its jaws in the north, and cinders rained from the sky for 5 years, and not a blade of grass would grow.
What does it matter? Asks the man with the birthmark. The world is different now. The sea is gone. The Khosrajis are gone. The Imperial Wolf has been replaced by lesser jackals, but they rend us still. We need territory and a hard-fisted battle plan, not hazy dreams of an Uroth united. We must...
Telupeke,
says someone, barely repressing a shout. The girl has entered, last of the travelers, and her appearance provokes a flurry of gasps. She herself is silent, aware of some breach of protocol, but as she moves through the crowd, her whole body becomes radiant with feeling as scores of comrades reach for her, squeeze her shoulders, touch her hands. Some faces light with joy. A lesser number with aversion or scorn. The man with the spider mark looks pointedly away.
As I was saying, just a moment, Captain.
The voice, deep and gravelly, carves a space of silence in the room.
One of our own has just come back to us. Welcome, Sister Talupeke. It warmed my heart when they told me you still lived.
Tabasa, of course. From where he is standing, Condry cannot see him for the attendants crowding about his chair. But Talupeke can. She turns to face his chair, draws herself straight as a poleaxe, raises both fists to her forehead in a crisp salute.
General!
Her voice catches. Condry and Chindelin exchange a look. This girl, who hurls knives and climbs towers, who fights like the devil incarnate, is afraid. Elated, perhaps even overjoyed, but afraid. Of displeasing Tabasa? Of something he might ask? Of accounting for herself since the loss of her unit?
You've made some new friends, rasps the general. Most peculiar friends, even by our standards. Take some wine, sister. We'll talk presently and decide what to do with these mongrels. Now carry on, Captain, but briefly, man. This isn't dinner theater.
The laughter is too keen. These warriors like to flatter their general. As the captain with the birthmark resumes his address, Mansari crooks a finger, leads them toward an empty stretch of wall. Condry endures the warrior's merciless scrutiny. Who can blame them? Survival in war means grasping every possible threat, and their appraisal is no worse than what seasoned warriors show recruits on their first day of service to the Prophet. But that reflection does not sit well with Condry, somehow. He claims his bit of wall, and turning, sees Tabassa at once. The man is large and haggard, with a broad brown face that is deeply scored rather than wrinkled, a face like an eroded cliff. Gray beard full and unruly, eyes full of wickedness and mirth. No hat, black or otherwise, but on his left forearm is a scar like a long purple centipede, trailing from the wrist into the sleeve he has rolled to the elbow. The arm, immensely strong, rests on the table. The hand is large and brutal, like a thing of hide. With his other hand, the general is jotting with a quill pen in a ledger book. The instrument looks absurdly flimsy in his grip, but the words flow smoothly. Eight or nine men crowd around Tabassa's chair. Stilts, the eldest by far, is pointing at a line in the ledger book and whispering in the general's ear. Tabassa nods. His cunning eyes flick upward.
Thank you, Captain. That will do. Mr. Demarok, you've paid our northern friends a visit, I believe. What have the Shoal to say for themselves?
A tall soldier with narrow cheeks pushes his way to the table.
Little to nothing, my general, he says. Their ranks have been decimated. They have a few men yet in the Shirasan Hills, but not enough to be of service to our cause.
They were never of service to our cause, says the general. But in the past they could be counted on to fight for their own. You can't mean they're abandoning the Southwest Corridor.
Not officially, general. The flag of the Scarlet Kingdom still flies on the summit of Mount Inutuk, and the men there expect a relief force sooner or later. But later may prove too late. The Shoal have lost their other strongholds in this country already, and half their leaders are in chains. The relief force may find no one to relieve.
And the provisions we bargained for? Demands the general. Black rice and barley and 30 cattle on the hoof? My men are peculiar, Demarok. They like to eat.
The warriors laugh again. Discreetly, Condry's eyes travel the room. In fact, not everyone is a warrior. At the table are two well-heeled men. Fine cloaks, jeweled fingers, he pegs as merchants. A small fellow in horn-rimmed spectacles behind a heap of books and scroll cases, and a youth of 18 or 19, regal of bearing, in a fine blue high-collared shirt with buttons of gleaming pearl. The youth's skin is dark olive, his hair glossy black. His hands, folded together on the table, have the cleanest nails Condry has ever seen. His face is composed, but his eyes betray a certain anxiety. Condry is bewildered by the debate. The general is apparently reviewing the whole tactical situation of the Lutaral, but the names fly too quickly. Are they discussing clans, roads, factions, militia, mountains? He cannot say, and yet he feels a throb of hope in his chest. A glance at Chindelin earns him a nod. His uncle feels it too. This is a war council. It is a good sign that they have been allowed to be here at all. The council is a long one, however. For 20 or 30 minutes, the men speak of nothing but food. Another quarter hour is devoted to speculations on the length of the winter, and when the first killing heat of spring will descend. Tabassa, even when silent, remains firmly in control. To some he is ravenously attentive, to others mildly disdainful, scribbling in his ledger or muttering with stilts as they speak.
At length, talk moves to the prophet and whether or not she is likely to advance on the Lutaral in the near future. Condri and Chindelin exchange looks. The Lutaral?
She has the men for such an assault, says the man with the birthmark. But she has marched them too far, stretched herself too thin. Fighting on three fronts, pouring her legions up and down the Milea like so much sand through an hourglass, exhausting them. These are a brute's tactics, are they not?
Many look surprised at this remark. The silver-haired woman at the table eyes him scornfully.
Your brute has taken 400 miles of territory back from the Vajex, Spider, she says.
But can she keep it? Says one of the bejeweled merchants. Can the old dog swallow that much meat?
No, says Spider. It will be torn from her jaws. Remember, brothers and sisters, the Khosraj never looked stronger than in its final years. This much I will grant, however, that the prophet caught the Vajex with their breeches down.
Who can blame them? Interjects someone. Who'd ever heard of organized Chilotos before she came along?
Let alone a Chiloto army, Spider continues. But the Vajex aren't fighting bare-assed any longer. They have retaken the lowlands, and with it, the breadbasket of their kingdom.
And that is nothing, says the youth in the high-collared shirt, compared to their alliance with the Shoal.
Correction, my lord, says Stilts, bowing slightly to the youth. They have an armistice, not a formal alliance.
What matter the word, says Spider. Vajex and Shoal are no longer killing each other. Both will have men to spare for killing Chilotos.
All the same, you underestimate the prophet, the older woman insists.
The man's upper lip curls in amusement.
Far be it from me to doubt a grandmother, he says.
Someone hisses. The general, raising his eyes from his ledger book, studies Spider wordlessly. The old woman is unmoved. She gathers her thick silver hair in her hands and ties it at the back. A look of great unease comes over Spider. He turns to the woman and bows.
Forgive me, elder sister. I referred to the prophet only. Not for all the world would I disparage you.
Not twice you wouldn't, says the woman.
Captain, says the general, finish your thought.
Spider nods.
It is merely this, sir, that the prophet is no soldier. The great countries of the north are led by warrior kings, men of iron and intellect, men trained in the oldest martial traditions of Uroth. But who leads this sloppy thing, this boneless mass called the Army of Revelation? I'll say it plainly, a bitch, a ferocious bitch, but a failing one, with rotten teeth and addled dreams of godhood. A stumbling old seer with a pet baboon and her 11 precious sons.
10,
says Talupeke, and the room goes silent. All eyes turn to the girl. She looks back at them, standing her ground. Spider at last has no choice but to acknowledge her presence. His glance is cold.
10, he says.
Or maybe 9, says Talupeke. One of them was stabbed. I don't know if he lived.
Silence. For a moment, the chamber feels like what it is, a basement. Then the general begins to laugh.
It's true, he tells the astonished crowd. The thirdborn, the maniac Ojulon, is dead. Chopped to pieces while savaging a child. And Garatajic, the scholar, son, he was ambushed and stabbed by an accomplice of the first killer. His soldiers found him at death's door. The news reached me just yesterday, and our sister Talupeke has confirmed it.
A soft explosion follows his words. No one shouts, but every face changes, every throat makes a sound of astonishment. Stilts and several others wave their arms and hiss,
"Order! Order, damn it all! You're not in nursery school!"
"But who were these people who managed to strike the sons of heaven?"
asks the youth in the high-collared shirt.
"Who, indeed?"
says Tabassa. Master assassins, no doubt. They infiltrated the Prophet's army some years ago and fled like the wind after their deeds. That is all I can tell you. Pray for these men of courage, if you're the praying kind.
Khandri sits frozen, not daring to glance at his friends. He's keeping us a secret. He doesn't trust his men entirely. How could he, if there's really a traitor in the ranks? Tabassa's pen stabs up at Spider.
Captain Sorfik, you dismiss the Prophet, known to her people as the Radiant One and the mother of all Chilotos, as a fool. I reject your verdict. I would sooner call him a fool who attributes 25 years of bloody conquest to mere ferocity. Her enemies are no longer fighting each other, true enough. But their armistice, and the word matters, Spider. Words always matter. Is a reflection of their fear of that woman. It is a well-grounded fear. She has stretched her forces thin, but they will stretch further yet. And with every mile clawed back from the Vajiks, she enlarges her pool of conscripts. More telling, though, is her gift for turning conscripts into believers. Into worshippers who kill and die at her whim. In this, she is the master of her age. Yes, I would call him a fool who predicts the decline of the Prophet.
Spider stares fixedly at the table. He looks like a man who has taken a mule kick to the chest.
I would call him a fool, says the general again. Except that by such measure, all Uroth is populated by fools. To this very day, the Vajeks are waiting for her collapse, depending on it, even. As for the Shoal and the Lanetu and the other great clans, they have simply no idea. The Prophet is a volcano, and thus far she has belched only a little fire. If she should erupt, no one, absolutely no one, will be prepared.
The youth in the high-collared shirt gestures at Khandri and Chindalin.
What of these newcomers, General? For I would swear they too are Chilotos.
Even Chilotos may be enemies of the Prophet, my lord, says Tabassa.
Did they bring you the news of the assassinations? Are they collaborators of yours?
You will forgive me, Prince Naraba, if I observe that my council's guest list is none of your affair. In fact, it serves no one's interests for me to answer such questions, not even yours or your city's. What's that you're saying?
A soldier is whispering to Stilts, who bends in turn to speak into Tabassa's ear.
Good, says the general. Let them enter. I should like to see the proof.
A door on Khandri's left is unbolted and swung wide. 4 huge, filthy soldiers pass into the room and stand in a cluster. They reek of sweat and horses. Mud and grime rain from their clothes. They draw themselves up and salute the general, and Tabassa answers in kind.
Riders, he says, you're back, and your faces make plain that you've succeeded. Am I right?
You are, my general,
rasps one of the men.
We rode one horse to its death, and Riphalon's was failing. We left him in the care of the monks at Sigra Cross.
But we did the job.
He lifts a canvas sack uncertainly, eyes swiveling around the room.
Exactly to order, sir.
Show us, then.
The sack is tied with rope. The man's soiled fingers tear at the knot, then the sack yawns open to a buzzing of flies. The man reaches inside and withdraws 2 severed heads, dangling from his fist by their hair. Khandri is afraid he will disgrace himself by vomiting. A man's head and a woman's. Their eyes are open and their lips puckered. Gore is clotted thick below their chins. Khandri catches his uncle's eye. What the fuck are we doing here?
Mr. Demas, says the general.
A man approaches the table, grimacing. He is small and plump, with sweaty cheeks and pouting, babyish lips.
Eshet turns to Condri and whispers,
"That's him. That's the owner of the caravan, the one we spoke to this morning."
The man presses a kerchief to his mouth as he studies the heads.
"These two were their leaders," he says. "The ones who robbed me? I didn't know you planned to kill them."
"They would not yield, General," says the man holding the heads.
"Perhaps they expected to be turned over to the Ursaad," says Stilts. "I wouldn't yield either, if I had that on my mind. I've seen how he punishes theft."
"What about the gold I paid them?"
says the man with the kerchief.
"Was that recovered?"
"You recall the terms perfectly well, Mr. Dimas," says Tabassa. "We keep the gold, and you keep your reputation as a man not to be trifled with."
He leans forward on his elbows.
"You are not, I trust, having second thoughts?"
"Not on my life, sir,"
says the caravan owner, with a gesture of appeasement.
"It is merely that I could prove the extent of my gratitude by doubling what your men have taken off these scoundrels, if I had funds left for the trading journey to Shefidong. And I could give my troops a month of roast duck and royal consorts if I could seize the Vajik throne," says Tabassa. "No, Mr. Dimas, I will not part with our winnings, and I cannot spare the men you wish to hire as a desert guard."
"But, General, what am I to do?"
"I should think the choice is fairly obvious. Secure such men as you can and brave the crossing, or sell your camels and wait the season out."
Tabassa looks away from the caravan owner.
"Riders, well done. Go to your rest. You can report in full on the morrow. Now then, about the Loak brigades."
The four riders depart with their grisly trophies, and Mr. Dimas, stunned, returns to his chair. Condri, hardly less unsettled, glances at Chindelin. The message in the smith's eyes is unmistakable. No one's safe with this man. Telepeke's head is bowed. There is a heaviness in her shoulders. Behind her mask of callousness, the girl is worried for their sakes. Dawn is surely near. Will their plight even be discussed? Maybe the general is toying with them. Maybe he will grill them for information and then cast them out on the road. His head jerks up. Once more the chamber has fallen silent. Black Hat Tabassa is looking at him fixedly.
"This one's gone wool gathering," he says. "You didn't even hear my question, did you, boy? Well, what about you then, blacksmith? What would you do with the killers of the Prophet's sons?"
"What, sir, myself?" sputters Chindelin.
"That is what I meant by you. How would you respond if they appeared at your door seeking refuge, asking you to hide them or help them escape?"
"I would have to ponder that question, General."
"Bollocks. Answer me. If the winds of Uroth blew these two men, whoever they might be, to your doorstep, would you help them?"
"Yes," says Chindelin. "I suppose I would."
"Even if one of them was an unhinged clown?"
"Yes."
"Even if you had a family to protect?"
Chindelin squares his shoulders.
"Who's to say I haven't?"
"I say it," says Tabassa. "I say you're a washed-up Sulanji bushwalker who's just dragged himself across the stolen sea. You may have had family, but you've abandoned them, or let someone take them from you. Who in Jekka's hell do you think you are?" "The last chance of a fat old ironmonger," says the general. "So watch your mouth and answer the fucking question. Would you help them, if to do so put your family at risk?"
Eshet's hand is on Chindelin's shoulder. The smith crosses his huge arms. For the third time, but now almost spitting the word, he says yes.
"By the gods,"
Tabassa smiles without warmth.
"We have a saint among us, boys. We should file by and kiss his ring. But then, saints get themselves killed all the time. As for protecting their family, that's not something a saint cares to think about.
His face twists with sudden irritation. He pushes the chair back from the table and lifts his arms. The men behind him retreat a few steps, all save Mansari and the warrior to his left, who bend down swiftly to either side of the general. Tabassa puts his arms over their shoulders, and the men lift him from the chair. Khandri tries not to stare. The general's legs dangle limp beneath his powerful torso. His large brown feet are bare, and as the soldiers carry him, they drag and scrape along the floor. Black Hat Tabassa is paralyzed. His men bring him abreast of the travelers. Talupeke stands rigid, eyes locked on the general's face. Her mouth works. Tabassa grunts at his men, who pause.
"Blackworms," he says. "Didn't you wonder how I escaped the slaughter at the Maghreb? Our dead were left where they fell. The walls of the gorge were so steep that the prophet's men could not extract the corpses. To be sure that none were still alive, they poured blackworms on us from above. 10 feet from me, a man was feigning death, but when the worms struck him, he could not bear it. He snatched at them, and the Chilotos shot him full of arrows. When my turn came, I lay still, and the vermin buried themselves in my flesh. What do you think of your general now, Talupeke? Can he carry on the fight, do you think?"
The girl is visibly trembling. She opens her mouth to speak, but no sound comes.
"I can move my right foot since yesterday. That is something. And I can feel the prick of a pin on both heels. The doctors tell me I shall never walk again. I tell them my plans require it."
His eyes move to Khandri.
"Do you know that cluster of stars men call the Scythe?"
Khandri nods. "I know it, sir."
"Then get yourselves to the Hermit tomorrow night before the Scythe drops below the horizon. That is about 6 minutes to midnight this time of year. If you're late, don't bother to come at all."
He turns to Talupeke.
"You must take your leave of them now, girl, unless you wish to quit my service."
"No,"
hisses Talupeke.
"General, no.
Her voice is tight with alarm. Tabassa's eyes soften a bit. Taking a deep breath, he frees his arm from around Mansari and reaches, lunges, really, for her shoulder.
"I am glad," he says, as she catches his weight. "You're irreplaceable, you know. Mr. Stilts, Sister Talupeke needs a uniform. As for you,"
his eyes rake Khandri, Chindalin, and Eshet,
"give thanks to On that your paths crossed this little one's for a time."
He flings his arm around Mansari again, and the three figures move toward the door. The council dissolves. The warriors rise and leave one unit at a time.
"Wait here a bit," Stilts tells Khandri's company. "You're going with me, and I'm last out the door tonight."
"The doctor," says Khandri. "My brother."
"All in good time, boy."
"Stilts,"
says Talupeke, still visibly shaken.
"Where are the rest of us?"
The Nadumon looks at her over his spectacles.
"The main force," says Talupeke. "I thought they'd be here tonight. I thought you were bringing everyone to the city."
Stilts takes Talupeke's hand, guides it gently to the back of a chair.
"We did," he murmurs. "You're looking at them. But keep silent for Ong's sake. There's guests among us yet."
For the second time in 5 minutes, Talupeke is rigid with shock.
"All of you back over there," says Stilts
with an impatient gesture. He rushes to intercept the merchants, who are drifting toward the door, whispering and frowning. Chindalin looks at Khandri, wide-eyed.
"How does Tabassa travel?" he whispers. "Do they drag him around like a sack of meal?"
Khandri shakes his head, dumbfounded. The questions run deeper than that.
How does Tabassa keep their loyalty when he can't even stand up from the table, let alone lead any more of his famous raids? Stilts takes gracious leave of each merchant by name. He seems to be having three conversations at once, all in soothing patter.
Concerned? Gentlemen, of course he's concerned. Your security is our security. Who knows this better than the general?
He certainly knows who butters his bread, grumbles one of the merchants. Stilts assumes a look of elaborate injury.
Dear sir, is that fair? Go home, we're all exhausted. And think of how well you sleep knowing who guarantees the safety of the Smoke Road. Your trade routes are safe today and will be safe tomorrow. And what is that not worth?
Friends help one another, sometimes with arms, sometimes with gold and provisions.
It's that simple. Go in peace.
He pivots away from them, his smile gone faster than a flung shoe. His eyes sweep the chamber, settling at last on the youth in the fine blue shirt, the one the general had addressed as a prince. The Nadoman approaches his chair and makes a formal bow. The youth sweeps his fine black hair back over his shoulders and rises with dignity. Stilts conducts him to the door, nodding at the man's quiet words.
A disaster not just for my people, Mr. Stilts, but for all Uroth, and even the world beyond. That is the heart of my missive, and I would know that General Tabassa has received it before I leave empty-handed.
Once more, Stilts affects a wounded look.
Empty-handed? Come now, my lord. The general has expressed his deep commitment to your cause, but these campaigns take time. There is less time than anyone imagines, I fear.
Then no time at all for mistakes, Prince Naraba.
Charge in like a bull and be slaughtered like a bull. And what good will that do your city?
But a fox will watch and learn and move in silence and strike unseen when the moment comes.
We must be foxes, my lord. Surely you can see that for yourself.
The young prince gives him a long final look.
The Sartaffs of the North, he says, do not mount bulls' heads on their walls. But I have heard they carpet the floors of their bedchambers in pelts.
Stilts smiles, but Condri does not hear his reply, for at that moment Talupeke touches his arm. She has banished every trace of shock from her expression. She stands with a dozen soldiers, ready to depart.
Condri,
she says, and he realizes that she has never before spoken his name. He feels a startling ache. The girl is only doing as she promised she would, as Eshet will do when they reach her village, as everyone does in time. All the same, he would like to hold and protect her. Ridiculous sentiment. Which of them has done the most protecting? The gods keep you safe, he says. Where are you going, do you know?
Where they send us, says Talupeke.
The south, maybe? Plenty of fighting down there.
We'd have died without you, says Condri. Talupeke nods in agreement. From the doorway, a soldier calls her name. Again, Condri feels the urge to embrace her. As if sensing the impulse, she pivots away from him, one side of her face smiling scornfully.
Keep Metu alive. He's unusual.
He is that, says Condri.
Like some kind of rare bird. And he loves you, so...
She breaks off. Chindlin has stepped near her. The smith's face is frozen in a hard expression, but his eyes are moist. Talupeke fidgets, her smile still more forced, her gaze anywhere but on him.
Old goat, she mutters.
Chindlin starts to twist a ring on his finger. Talupeke sees what he is doing and mutters,
Fuck.
Chindlin grits his teeth and pulls, and the ring pops into his hand.
Blade steel, he says, holding it out to her. From my grandfather's forge in South Melange. He made it for me from a piece of his grandfather's sword, and that weapon came from Imperial times. He was a clever man, my grandfather. He said I'd know when to pass this ring along. Even if I never had a child of my own.
Telopeke flings her gaze at the door.
"Will you wear it?" says Chindelin. "Aunt's tears, can you not even look?"